Well, I am so pumped to get to be with y'all this morning. We have gathered along with people all over the world to celebrate the birth of a child who was, you know, born in a remote location. At first, nobody really knew who he was, but his influence through the years has spread and impacted people all over the world. I'm talking, of course, about this child. If you could, yes. You recognize that picture? We got that from your brother. Tim Sittler got that from your brother. Oh, that made me so happy. I was so excited about that. This is what...
go back.
You want to see it? Can you go back? Can you go back to the picture?
I want you to notice my sense of style. Even
it's still the same, yeah.
Even then. It was... And so, I have two-toned shoes on. You just can't see those.
You remember taking this picture.
Yes, I was unhappy.
Yeah, that's...
I'd been crying right up to that moment. They said, smile, and I went...
I know that face. So, if you don't know, this is Randy Harris. Brother Randy was my best friend for all the years that Leslie and I lived in Abilene. He poured into me and Leslie and just a great mentor and friend, but he's also a fellow Arkansan. And so I knew he was going to be here for Christmas, and I got him to Little Rock because the Razorbacks were playing in Little Rock last night. So, you know, he's a Razorback fan as well. And the reason I like getting Randy in front of as many people as I can is because, sincerely, Randy is a lot like Jesus. And I think too often we like what people's ideas, but we don't pay attention to the character that those ideas produce. I want you to listen to people who are like Jesus. Randy is full of the fruits of the Spirit, and it matters a lot that you listen to people like Jesus, because think about how much we talk about Jesus. There's a lot of people who talk about Jesus who don't talk like Jesus, right? I mean, think about this. Jesus has been the most influential person in human history. I mean, the next 10 people combined don't compare to how much Jesus has changed the world. So much so that people who don't even believe in Jesus use his name as a swear word. Like, we don't do this with other historical characters. Nobody hits their thumb with a hammer and goes, Martin Luther King Jr., right? There's something about Jesus. There are more books in the Library of Congress about Jesus than any other historical figure. There have been hundreds of movies made about Jesus. And I'm talking about things like The Passion to, I kid you not, this is an actual thing. There's a kung fu horror film called Jesus Christ Vampire Slayer, which is not a movie I recommend.
Did you see it?
No, I have not seen it. I just...
So you really don't know.
No, well, yes, that's true. You okay. Go try it out if you want to. But
when I my freshman ministry majors come into my class, we always sort of have this conversation. A lot of them have taken the Myers-Briggs personality profile. Raise your hand if you've taken the Myers-Briggs personality profile. Okay. For the rest of you, it's one of those personality profiles that reduces your whole personality to 4 letters. And I really only need 3. I need 3 letters and that sweater. I say, okay, I want you to figure out what Jesus is on the Myers-Briggs test. And my Jesus turns out to be an INTJ, which just happens to be what I am.
Yeah.
And the point is, Jesus can't be just anybody you want him to be. He already is somebody.
Yeah.
And we have this tendency to want to project ourselves on Jesus, and there's nothing transforming about that. It's only transforming when the real Jesus gets projected on us. And so I sort of tell him, okay, I know you're in here because you love Jesus. Now let's see if we can fall in love with the real Jesus.
There, it's been said, you know, God made us in his image, and we have been more than willing to return the favor. Let me give you an example of how clearly you can see this. There is a guy who said, in boundless love as a Christian, I read how terrific Jesus' fight was against the Jewish poison, Adolf Hitler. And who doesn't think of boundless love when they think of Adolf Hitler? But you can see what Randy's talking about very clearly in that quote, right? I mean, Jesus doesn't hate Jews or consider them Jewish poison. Hitler does. And that leads me to the undeniable conclusion, some Jesuses should be rejected, right? And this is a biblical thing. Like, think about what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11. He says, if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preach, this is really important because Jesus' name is in the air all over the Bible Belt. But if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preach, a Jesus that would be known by the fruits of the Spirit, a Jesus that would be known by the kind of kindness and mercy that seemed to characterize his ministry. If someone comes and preaches a Jesus other than that, or if you receive a different spirit from the spirit you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. Paul acknowledges there are some Jesuses that we should not follow. Now think about it. You've seen a lot of different kind of Jesuses, right? There's flannel graph Jesus that just stays in the church building, doesn't have anything to do with your life. There's, you know, the flowing Clairol hair Jesus that looks really great, has a beauty pageant sash. He says things like, I love puppies, but he doesn't really say anything hard to your own life. There's Republican CEO Jesus. There's Democrat Jesus. There's Libertarian Jesus. There's the American Jesus who supports every war America ever goes in. There's Southern Jesus who supported Jim Crow and sounds more like a Pharisee than Jesus of the Gospels. That's why in my first full year here, I wanted to preach through the Gospel of Luke. Because we're the church of Christ. And often we put too much emphasis on church and not enough on Christ. Jesus is the whole thing. Jesus is the pattern. He's the cornerstone. He's the Alpha and Omega. He is the whole enchilada. And if we don't have Jesus, we don't have anything.
So one of the things I do with my freshmen again is I tell them, okay, one of the things you have to do in this class is you have to pay attention to the times when Jesus makes you angry.
Yeah.
And at the end of this class, you can't say there was ever a time when Jesus made me angry. You are not listening carefully enough. Mm. I want them to pick out what are the things that Jesus talks to you about that you like the least. Mm. In my particular case, it's Jesus teaching on forgiveness, which I think is ridiculous. How many times should I forgive the one who sins against me? Seven times? You want to know the Harris commentary on that? I think seven is generous. If you're in my class, you won't get seven. And Jesus says, no, not seven times, 77 times, or 490. There's a translation problem there, but it means the same thing either way. If you're counting, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Do you like that? You know, it's hard enough to forgive people when you think they deserve it, much less when you're sure they don't. It's one of the hardest things Jesus ever says. There was a guy once who didn't like me, and he would write all these nasty things about me, and it was very irritating. And some of them weren't true. I had a friend come to town. He started writing ugly things about him, and my friend's a lot more spiritual than I am. Says, you know, brother so-and-so, I've been praying for him every day. And I'm thinking, well, I've been praying for him every day too, but so far he's still in good health. And it's just at that moment that you find out if you take Jesus seriously or not. Because you don't get to pick and choose. You can't make Jesus just anybody you want him to be. He already is somebody. And I frequently run into students who have a sort of grudge or a grief against the church. But I don't run into very many that I can't get interested in Jesus.
Right.
And most of them are very compelled by Jesus. Some are pushed away, but that was true when Jesus was Jesus. The whole point is, okay, can I get down to Jesus? Yeah. Can I get you to make a decision about Jesus? Because that's what determines whether a person's a Christian or not.
Yeah. So I read a few years ago this article in USA Today, and it's front page on the USA Today, and it was about how do Americans see God. And the main premise was, while most of us use the word God to talk about what it is in the higher power, more often than not, we don't agree on what kind of God we're talking about. And it wasn't people who were Jewish or Islam. It was mainly people who consider themselves followers of Jesus, but they're all over the map on what kind of God Jesus represents. And they broke it down in this article onto four different views of God. Basically, there's one, the authoritative God. There's two, the distant God. Three is the critical God, and four is the benevolent God. And it may not seem like that kind of that should be on the front page of USA Today, but here's what the reasons that they were publishing this. It said most of our national politics come down to this, from our national budget to policies on war or gay rights. Most of these are worked out by how we believe about God. So this is a survey done from Baylor University, and it's just fascinating. So basically what they did after surveying, you know, tens of thousands of people, they found out that if you believe in an authoritative God, you're more likely to be politically conservative. If you divide, you know, you divide the world up into good and evil. If you believe in a distant God, you're more likely to lean left politically. And you know, so on. And so all these people are using the same words with radically different meanings. Now, chances are, you already have some idea, even when I read off that list of the four different categories, what kind of idea comes into your mind when you think of God. But it's just not something we step back and think of. But it makes a huge difference in every one of our lives.
Yeah. I think that if you take the Bible seriously, it tells you that if you want to know who God is, you look clearly at Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's as clear as it's going to get. You can find out some things about God by looking at the history of Israel, and you can find out some things about God by looking at nature. But if you really want to know who God is the one who made himself known in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And so Jesus can say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And whatever our notions about God are, they have to be read through Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So you've been in Luke, and because this amuses you, you've given me a very difficult story. It's also a story that makes me cry. So he says, "Okay, I want you to talk about the thief on the cross." Okay. Have you taught them the first principle of good Bible study?
You mean your first principle of good Bible study?
There is only one. Good. Yes.
Left to right.
Yeah, read the Bible.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
the first. It's amazing how many people don't know the first principle of good Bible study is to read the Bible.
Yeah.
Okay, there are other principles, but the first principle is read the Bible. Okay, so I'm in Luke chapter 23. I'll guess I'll start at verse 36. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." There was a written notice about him which read, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him, "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. This man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise." A passage that's launched 1,000 heresies. Let me just do the Bible student thing and point out to you things that most of you know, but some of you don't. Luke is the one and only gospel that tells this story. There is no good thief in Matthew. There is no good thief in Mark. There is no good thief in John. Luke is the only one who tells this story. And of all the things that Luke could choose to remember and tell us, this story is so important to him that he has to put it in there. That gets my heart beating. Okay, why does this mean so much to Luke? And I'm sure Jonathan has got you in the habit now of saying Luke Acts. Luke Acts. Luke Acts. Luke Acts. Luke Acts. It's Matthew, Mark, Luke Acts, John. Or it's Matthew, Mark, John, Luke Acts. It is most assuredly not Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts. Luke Acts. Every story in the book of Acts has to be interpreted through the first volume of the book of Luke. Every story in the book of Luke has to be interpreted through its completion in the book of Acts. They go together. And one of the most rewarding ways of reading Luke Acts is this. It is one long exposition on trying to answer one question. Who gets invited to the party? That's what it's about. You have this parable in Luke chapter 14 where Jesus says, okay, the people are invited to the party, won't come, so I want you to go out to the highways and byways and bring people in. And Jesus' primary disagreement with the Jewish leaders in Luke is about who gets invited to the party, because they want to keep throwing people off the guest list and Jesus wants to keep inviting more. And here we have the ultimate culmination of that. Okay, I don't know what this guy did to get crucified. You're quickly assuming he's a really bad guy, but I want to assure you there are a lot of people who got crucified by the Romans who weren't. And he's probably doing something to sort of stir things up. He's probably not a pickpocket. He's probably some sort of Jewish insurrectionist. And he's dying. In mere moments, he'll be dead. He's naked. He's helpless. He's in enormous pain. He comes to the table with absolutely nothing. And essentially asks Jesus a question. Can I come to the party? Jesus says, you bet. You bet you can come to the party, because there's just one qualification for coming to the party, and that's saying yes to Jesus. And not only are you going to come to the party, but Samaritans are going to come to the party, and Gentiles are going to come to the party, and Romans are going to come to the party, and the poor are going to come to the party, and men and women are going to come to the party. I'm not going to be satisfied. I was listening to that prayer earlier. Till everybody comes to the party.
Randy, let me stop you there, because you're the teacher of preachers in our fellowship, and... Sounds like you're getting soft on baptism, because this is a story that other tribes talk about a lot, not us.
Yeah, well, I want it back. I want this story back. What's the first principle of Bible study?
Reading the Bible.
Reading the Bible. Okay. Luke Acts. Luke Acts. Luke Acts. I was studying Luke Acts with a... unbeliever one time, actually a really hostile unbeliever. And Jesus kind of won this person's heart as we were studying. It was really cool to watch. And if we read all the way through Luke, and then we get to Acts. And I decided to kind of do this thing I do sometimes, and He says, look, there are people being baptized here. And I said, oh, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Let's read. And we go further on. I said, hey, look, here are more people being baptized. And I said, you keep bringing that up. Do you have some point? No, I'm sorry. Okay, let's read. And we read some more. And he says, here's some more people being baptized. When do I get to be baptized? And I pause and say to myself, oh, Randy, you're so good. which is to say, Luke is the only one who includes this story, but whose teaching on baptism is so clear and unequivocal that you don't even have to teach it to anybody. They'll read their way into it. So it's not a baptism story. There are plenty of those baptism stories in Luke Acts. It's a story about saying yes. And as Christianity emerges at Pentecost, the first yes that you say to God is baptism.
Yeah. That's our thief on the cross moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just wasn't handy at that moment for
sure.
You know, and you know we didn't have the events of Pentecost that drive that, but the power of the story is, if there was anybody who you didn't think should come to the party, it's this guy. And all he asks is to come. And Jesus says, come on.
Yeah.
I want them all to come. So there's a story about somebody Jesus hardly knows. I think you want to tell a story about one of Jesus' best friends.
That's right. So I need some help for this next section. We've already got some people, but I need four adult males. I see my nephew, Gary. If you could come up, I need adult males. So let's see. Jordan got voluntold by his cousin Cooper. So come on up, Jordan. And then let's see. Scott, do you mind helping? And then nobody raise your hand. Okay. Yep, Madison. Thank you. Madison got volunteer too. A lot of people generous with their husbands. Okay. So,
in this context.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So go to Courtney in the back. Courtney has directions for you, and y'all come back out in a couple of minutes. Okay. Thanks so much. So, the same time I was reading this USA Today article about how Americans view God, I was also reading another article about how Americans, Christians in America, view themselves. And over again, we described ourselves, when we read through the New Testament, as one character. The majority of Americans see themselves through the lens of one character. Anybody, any guesses? Peter. It's Peter, Jesus' disciple. I know when Randy tells the story about the thief on the cross, that for some of you, it's hard to believe God is that good. This is why we've been going through the Gospel of Luke for 23 chapters now. So you, when you get to that story, you're not surprised. This is the same God who's been telling these kind of stories. So remember the thief on the cross. This is what it looks like when Jesus is the father, when he's describing the prodigal son story. This is what it looks like when the father runs towards the prodigal. And do you remember what the prodigal says when he first meets his dad? I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, that's right. Call me a servant or a slave. I have a hunch that this is in the back of our minds every moment of our lives. I'm no longer worthy to be called a son or daughter. So most of us see ourselves as Peter. Did you ever think about Peter's life? Peter did so many great things, but he was also a giant screw up in the New Testament. He was impulsive. He was brash. He had that knack for always doing the wrong thing at the wrong moment. He strikes me as Kanye West of the Gospels, right? Like, he's also a follower of Jesus now. But Jesus is always... Kanye West is a hip-hop artist. He's a... Yeah.
people who wear the kind of sweater I had on don't know who Kanye West is.
Touche. So, Peter's constantly getting in trouble with Jesus. He's constantly being corrected by Jesus. So remember that one time where Jesus tells Peter he's going to die right after Peter has said, you're the Messiah? Jesus has just given him the keys to the kingdom, and apparently that gets to his head. And so Peter's going to try to tell the Messiah what it means to be the Messiah. And so Jesus calls Peter Satan. And you have not had a bad day until Jesus calls you Satan, right? Or what about when Peter is walking on water and then he has a lack of faith and he begins to sink? If we see ourselves as Peter, then we see God viewing us that way through those lenses. But what if we've misinterpreted them? What if we started the way we assume, what some things we assume about God, and then read the New Testament that way? And think God is always angry or disappointed with us or constantly pointing out our flaws. But what if God isn't like that? So last week in the Gospel of Luke, we saw Jesus had been betrayed by Judas. His closest friends have abandoned him. Even Peter, who had just promised, "I'll never leave you," even that Peter leaves too. And then when somebody starts coming and asking Peter about his past, Peter just totally denies knowing Jesus. And by the way, you get this. Because Jesus is being arrested on charges of treason and sedition. And if Peter says he knows him, he's going to be crucified too. So Peter denies him because he's thinking, "I'll live to fight another day. Even if it means I can't sleep at night." And that's when Jesus walks by. I'm going to read this story first and let the Gospel of Luke take it from here. And turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 22, starting in verse 54. It says, "Then they seized Jesus and they led him away and took him to the house of a high priest. Peter followed at a distance. And when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of a courtyard and sat down, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, 'This man was with him.' But he denied it. 'Woman, I don't know what you're talking about,' he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, 'You're also one of them.' 'Man, I am not,' Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, 'Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean.' Peter replied, 'Man, I don't know what you're talking about.' And just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him: 'Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times.' And then he went outside and wept bitterly." Did you notice that line? "The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter." That's where I would like to land for the rest of our time today. Here's where I needed the help for volunteers. Because it's one thing to hear this story, and it's another thing to see it. So let's read this one more time, and this time, let's act it out. Y'all ready? In verse 54, "Then they seized Jesus and led him away and took him to the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. And when someone there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard, they sat down together, and Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him there in the firelight, and she looked closely at him and said, 'This man was with him.' But he denied it. 'Woman, I don't know him,' he said. And then a little later, someone else saw him and said, 'You also are one of them.' 'Man, I am not,' Peter replied. About an hour later, someone else asserted, 'Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean.' And Peter replied, 'Man, I don't know what you're talking about.' And just as he was speaking, the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him: 'Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times,' and went outside and wept bitterly." Okay, I want to time out. I want to do a Zach Morrison and just time out on this story. And then ask you to think, what face is Jesus making at Peter? In this moment, when you're seeing the story kind of played out, what face do you think he is making at Peter? Because, and here's the thing I think is true about us: what you think the face is he's making about to Peter is what you think of when you think of God. Is it the same face your mom made when she was disappointed? Is it the same face your dad made when he was angry? Because if you think that that's what Jesus is like, you will think of following Jesus. You will think your concept of God will be like this. So just a couple of things I want to point out. One, this is one of the few times in Jesus' ministry he reaches into the future to say something. He tells Peter, he knows this moment is coming. He's he knows. He's not surprised. He's not shocked. He told Peter this was coming, and he also told Peter there's a future after your failure. He told Peter, after this has happened, remember to turn and strengthen your brothers. Peter, Jesus is not surprised in this moment. And the second thing I want you to see is that this look is an act of grace. Remember what Peter's doing here? Peter's denying he knows Jesus because he doesn't want to die. If Jesus wanted to, all he'd have to do is say, "It's okay, Peter, don't worry about it." And Peter's dead. This look is an act of grace. You want to know what Jesus is doing in this moment? He's reminding Peter of their conversation. He's reminding Peter, remember what I said? Not just that this would happen, but that I knew this would happen. And that after this is done, I'm not through with you, Peter. There's a future for you, Peter. That after this is done, God is going to use you to turn and strengthen your brothers. Okay, let's give it up for our impromptu actors. The reason I like that so much, the reason I want you to see it is because when I was asking around, like, who would be a good Jesus? I asked Denise Carnes if Scott would be a good Jesus. And she goes, no, he smiles way too much. And this is part of my point, right? Don't we realize after reading the gospel for the past year, this is who God actually is? This is who God always has been. God did not convert to Christianity when Jesus was born. God's not out to get you. God's not against you. God's not waiting for you to mess up to smite you. God has and always has been for you. Let me give you just one more example of how this is true and how we just read over it. You remember what the story right before this with Peter? You remember what happens? They come to arrest him. Peter's got a sword and he uses it and he chops off an ear, Malchus's ear. And you remember what Jesus does? He bends down, he picks up the ear and puts it back on the guy. He totally Mr. Potato Heads this guy. He just puts the ear back on him. And we read that and they're like, that's a neat little Bible story. But do you realize what Jesus is actually doing in that moment? If Malchus decides he wants to press charges against Peter, can you imagine the court scene? Excuse me, Your Honor, I would like to report that this man chopped off my ear. The judge would be like, which ear, Malchus? Like, well, you know, Jesus put it back on. It doesn't matter. He chopped off my ear, right? In this moment, Jesus has destroyed the evidence. What's the judge going to do? Jesus has destroyed the evidence against him. That's what Jesus did on the cross. Do you know the word Satan means the accuser? Some of us are really doing the work of Satan in our homes. Some of our wives are doing the work of Satan with our husbands. Some of our husbands are doing the work of Satan with our wives. Some of our parents are doing the work of Satan with our kids. And some of our kids are doing the work of Satan with our parents. Satan means the accuser. But what Jesus did on the cross is for every one of us. Because Satan, the defense attorney of the universe, has got stuff on every one of you. Hey God, I don't know if you know this, but they cheated on their taxes in 2011. God, I don't know if you know this, but he's got a lust problem. God, I don't know if you know this, but she's got a gossip problem. Ultimately, God, every one of them have got a sin problem. But the cross is God's verdict. Because we're all the thief on the cross. The cross is God's verdict of saying sin is bad. The ways we have hurt each other are real. And we have done real harm to each other. And yet, they don't have the last words in our life. Because the cross is God's way of saying over all who believe and follow Jesus, not guilty.
So I've had several occasions to be in court over the last several years. I've been on three juries. I'm a CASA volunteer, so I'm often in court with the kids that I'm representing. But I was in court recently in a situation I had never been in before. Somebody I cared about was on trial, and it had taken the case, I think, 4 or 5 years to get to court. And it was the last day. I went to hear the closing arguments. The jury goes out to deliberate. It's been a little while. Now it's over lunch. Now the jury is back in, and we're called back into the court. It's very hard to explain those feelings. This is the first time I had been in a courtroom where a jury was going to pronounce sentence, and I had no idea what it was going to be. And that in mere moments, somebody I cared about was either going to get in his car and go home and continue his life, or he was going to be handcuffed and hauled away, and things would never be the same again. And I was almost hyperventilating. I couldn't catch my breath. Okay. And I had another friend in jail at the time that I'd been visiting regularly, and I'm partly thinking about myself. I can't do this again. I can't do this again. And then you hear the words. Not guilty. Count number one. Not guilty. Count number two. Not guilty. Count number three. Not guilty. Count number four. I'll never hear those words. Not guilty. That are so important to the Christian faith in the same way again. That's what it feels like. I've spent the last 3 years reading the most important theological work of the 20th century. It's 13 volumes, 8,000 pages. But there's only one point. And that is, when God looks at you in Jesus Christ, he says, not guilty. And then he says something else. Why don't you come to the party? All you have to do to come to the party is say, yes. We're getting ready to enter into the Lord's Supper, which is one of our ways of declaring to one another every week God's verdict on us of not guilty. Let me remind you of a song you know by heart, and then Josh is going to lead you in a verse in it, because I have such confidence in you that you can sing it without the words. And I want you to think about the thief on the cross story. Just as I am, without one plea. But that thy blood was shed for me. O Lamb of God, I come. That's what we do when we come to the Lord's table.